This is GamesAtWork.biz with Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with. This is episode 209, Driving Doom. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Michael Rowe here on a beautiful Friday, the last official day of summer-ish, right? Because, you know, U.S. holiday happens this weekend, extended weekend for people, and then it's all over. The pools are closed. The kids are on buses everywhere, et cetera. And I'm here with my friend and co-host, Michael Martin. How's it going, Michael?
Yay. Doing great. Can't wait to get to this show. There's some fun stuff here today.
Yeah. Yeah, really fun. And so the first link, and I saw this, gosh, when was it? It was a couple of days ago, maybe even a week ago, somewhere around there. One of the second very first game I remember playing in 3D, because the first was Castle Wolfenstein.
Oh, yeah. Remember that one.
Right. But the second that really took off, and every single platform I was using at the time, DOS, Windows, OS 2, all had a version of this game called Doom.
Oh yeah.
Yes. And if you quick diversion. Did you watch the movie Doom that came out in like 2006?
No.
Oh, it's great. It was so campy. I loved it. Anyway, sorry. So saw this week. This is really cool. The game Doom has come out with iterations for forever, right? So the first one, like I think it was 94, 93 maybe even when it first came out. And there was a new version that came out in 2016. Ultra high graphics, you know, really, really cool stuff. I think the last one I've been playing was probably 2008, somewhere around that. Anyway, maybe even earlier than that. Anyway, there's a website where someone goes through and takes the games and looks at them from a point of view that the game is not at. So let me explain what I mean by that. In Doom, it's a first-person shooter, and you walk around and you kill these evil monsters on a base on Mars. That have spawned from the depths of hell. And you're always, the whole game, if you play it, you have kind of your hand sticking out in front with a gun in it, and you're killing things. Okay, so what this guy does is he takes and he moves the camera position outside of the frame of first person to let you see how the game is actually rendered and how... Yeah. Individual graphic elements are put together, and how the developers have gone about and pre-cache data, etc. And this YouTube video that's attached to this article talks about how silly the game looks like if you're not looking at it in first person, but if you're looking at it in third person. So, Michael, I know you've probably played Doom, and I know you've had a chance to look at the video. What did you think?
Well, so I have played Doom, and I did watch the video too, and it was interesting to see the third person experience here because you're not meant to see that. And when you think about efficiency of coding, you don't need to code and create and render and shade and do everything that no one will ever see. So it struck me kind of funny at first, but it makes a lot of sense. Why create a person's torso and head when all you're going to see is the front of their arm and the weapon that they're holding? So I thought it was a very efficient use of resources. And in the pre-show, you and I were talking a little bit about Second Life, and one of the things that could be done there, which was essentially detaching the eyeballs from your head and floating them around to get a different perspective of something, which was pretty useful, as I recall there, when you need to go see something that you couldn't fit the full frame of your avatar into. You couldn't walk up the stairs or climb up something, but you could send your eyeballs to go look at it and then bring them back to you, and then you can move the rest of your avatar's body. So to me, I thought it was pretty intriguing, and it showed the smart developers doing the smart developer thing.
Well, what really amazed me, because, I mean, you're spot on about performance characteristics and reducing the need for shaders and et cetera. But at the same time, there were examples where, you know, they completely rendered the detailed insides of the back of the monster's mouth, right?
Yeah.
So at certain times, they kind of go completely in the opposite direction. Instead of getting rid of all those layers and all those polygons and all those shaders and all, you know, everything.
All the prims. Yeah.
They do all of it just for the effect. And I'm wondering if that has to do with the physics engine that they use in certain parts, et cetera.
Maybe.
And what I really liked is, and you know, I do this a lot in World of Warcraft. I like to explore, right? That's one of the things I really enjoy about an open world game is going to those areas that are seldom seen, looking around, see how they do the environmental effects, you know, fogs and shadows, etc. And then seeing how there's one point in the video where the guy pulls completely out of the Mars base, and you get an overall view of how the entire base is set up. And you see where they did a lot of work around fog and shadows, but put like only half of the building up. Right.
Right.
Again, mm-hmm. it's so all these different trade-offs, even though you're probably never going to be outside in that area of Mars to see it. All the different shadows and all the different fog. But if you're in the building looking out the window, it's important to see it. But you'll never be on the
outside.
Other side of the building yeah. to see the half of it that's there and the half of it that's not. Even, you know, there's another example where there's this whole room structure that's hidden underneath the ground. Even though it doesn't need to be there, because it's just like this one scene where you kind of get out of the game and you're in this one room. But they actually build it, and they build it into the whole world and put it in a certain place for the convenience sake of having it in the entire model. It just fascinates me looking at the trade-offs of when they go for performance, when they go for convenience. Another example is many times they preload body parts underneath the floor around the complex. So when you go into a certain place, the body part will just kind of pop up out of the floor. And I'm wondering, you know, as a developer, I'm wondering what kind of performance tuning and performance tools you use to identify all the behavior in order to figure out, yeah, it's more efficient to preload the bloody leg under the floor than to load it as needed, right?
Yeah, well, and you don't get any lag then for that, because you can have things pop up, you know, where they need to be. I think in the cutscene for the end of the Doom game, the android kind of force calls something to their hand, which was in existence behind the person the whole time. And yeah, I mean,
but in other parts of the game, he says, you know, the exact same thing. They don't do that.
Right. Well, I mean, these are coding techniques, right? That's really what it boils down to, right?
They're
different devs
in
different spots.
Yeah, I wonder if it's a resource load issue at that point in the environment. So that cutscene that you're talking about at the end, I mean, I was sitting there watching. I was like, wow, that the amount of just pure amount of calculation that are going on, because this device that's sitting behind the player.
Right.
Has a lot of particle emitters, right? So it's kind of sparking and waving and doing all kinds of movement, which has got to be resource intensive, versus, you know, they, you know, popping out the shotgun, they can load that at real time, right? Because it's just a shotgun. It doesn't have particle emitters. So, but in certain environments, would they preload the shotgun because you're in an environment with this heavy use of particle emitters, right? So it's those trade-offs, again, that how do you model that as you're building out the level of the game? That's the part that I'm trying to wrap my head around, the tools and the processes for that, other than just a lot of playtesting.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, with you.
Well, speaking of playtesting, you know, sometimes you're hanging out and you go, hey, you know, tomorrow I would like to be in another city. And yep. One way you could do that is you could fly or take a train. What if you could just check into your hotel room and be there the next day in this other city? What do you think about that? Does that sound like something that could be interesting to you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I first saw this, I was like, this is really an interesting combination of several things. So Condé Nast had in their Traveler website a futuristic concept about a self-driving hotel room. They were calling them an autonomous hotel, right? So, or was ATS, was Autonomous Hotel System or
Travel
something
suite.
Like that? Travel Suite, yes. So imagine exactly what, Michael, you just said. You need to get to another city. You call up a hotel suite that comes to your door where you live. You get in, and the travel experience to get to the city is embodied with that vehicle, and then it docks at the larger hotel at your destination, and you can now be together with other people that have done a similar thing. So it was really interesting to me to say how might you reimagine travel to get from place to place. Now, this would require lots of very quick ground transportation. And I'm not sure that really would line up properly and well, because if you think about how long it takes to drive somewhere, even if you could do it at double or triple the speeds currently, it might be even more effective to just get there under your own steam, and you might not need to spend the night, right? So if you're traveling for 2 hours or 3 hours at two or three times as fast as you could travel when you're just driving at 65 miles an hour, you might not need to spend the night. So for this to be really a worthwhile experience, I would think it would have to be traveling fast enough and to get far enough away that you would want to spend the night to take advantage of all that.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking that same thing, and as you were describing that challenge, and as I kind of alluded to at the beginning with trains, right, in the travel car, why not just partner with the Boring Company and you get in the hotel room, the traveling hotel room, the autonomous travel suite, and yep. It just drops it down in one of the tunnels and goes at, you know, 400 or 500 miles an hour and gets you cross country.
Yeah, so my
because that's
my
when it
view,
has to get interesting.
Right. My view would be that's not going to be ground transportation. That's going to be flight.
Yeah.
So it could be a personalized flying hotel room as opposed to a ground transportation one.
Yeah. But and then at that point, why do you need a hotel room? Because if I'm flying and I'm going 400 something miles an hour, you know, a five hour flight cross country is not that bad.
Right.
I already do that with a plane. So is it just the fact that I could watch TV and maybe have my own bathroom?
Well, maybe, and that you have enough space to do something, right? So you could work or you could relax, or, you know, you might be able to eat in more comfort than you would if you were crammed
into.
Yeah,
but, you know, that now you get it. I love the meal idea. So now how do they deliver the food? You know, maybe they could have a staff there for that. And maybe, you know, then you start getting into optimizing the staff to serve more people. Maybe you could have, like, you and 100 to 200 of your closest friends sitting in this flying travel tube that allows you to eat. And then you start optimizing around space to reduce fuel costs. We could call that a plane.
Well, it also sounds kind of boring, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So I mean, maybe it's a train kind of a setup where you get to a place that is now a tube, not a plane
tube.
A
series
tube,
of tubes. It's an internet.
But a series of tubes. And that can take you across country at the speed that you might need to. So it's an intriguing notion.
Yes.
It's an intriguing notion, but it needs a few extra pieces of the puzzle that, in order for it to really hum, it can't be just, all right, your hotel room comes to you, picks you up, and takes you where you want to go. It's got to be more than that.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of those, you're spot on. This is one of those things that looks really cool until you start thinking through all of it.
Right.
My first reaction in the pre-show before we started recording was, you know, that design looks really nice with all that glass, but in hotel room, you know, I'm probably going to take a shower and I'm not going to want that. And you were like, well, you could, you know, dynamically make the walls opaque. And I'm like, yeah, until a software bug creeps in, like maybe saying, have you done your update? Have you done your update? Have you done your update? And suddenly you're standing there in the shower with glass all around, driving down a highway at 55 miles an hour. And everyone's going, hey, what you doing?
Yeah, yeah. And you don't want to be in a spot where something like that fails.
Well,
the more you take with you, right? So let's think about it. The amount of water that's necessary to do a
shower.
Yep. Water weighs a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to plan for the fuel and the acceleration and for that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, it's intriguing at one level when you get down to the details. I doubt they may soon become a reality.
Right.
But speaking of which, you know, if you're really worried about the software update causing the opaque walls to change, you probably want to, you know, have some kind of key or something that is required before an update can occur.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe almost like a security key. And you found an article about Google's security keys becoming available online now for your own two-factor login.
Yeah, I thought this was also an intriguing thing. So the notion behind the way Google does two-factor authentication with physical devices, this Titan security key, funny they have that name for it, incidentally, is now something that anybody can go buy. So they first set this up, Google had, to allow you to buy it if you were a Google customer of their cloud services and so on. And now you can go ahead and buy it and use this for authentication for a variety of services. So step one, big fan of two-step verification, two-factor verification like that. I like also that the way these keys are produced is to help ensure that even in the supply chain, there's not a hardware hack that could go against these keys. So high degree of trust in them. But the flip of all this for me was, okay, anything that you can encode, you can decode. Anything you can encrypt, you can decrypt. Anything that provides security can potentially be defeated too. So I wonder how much people might find a high level of use for something like this. Much like, remember those pagers, Michael, that folks used to carry around, that or cards, they would have a certain number on them that would change based on a seed from the time, and you would have to enter that number in on a web browser or something like that to prove that you were authorized to use whatever service that you were going to do. I don't know if this is something that you'd say, yeah, I really need this, because what I have today with two-factor authentication and being able to transmit codes securely to a phone and then enter that back in to verify you got the right code, you know, how much better is this?
Well, there's a couple of things. Well, one is SMS two-factor authentication is not as secure because you can spoof the phone number. And you can also spoof getting that encryption second factor verification.
Sure.
So I can't remember if it was the one of the federal standard organizations that recently stated that two-factor authentication over SMS was not considered secure. So,
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So. Having an app level, this is where I think you really want to go, is the time-based two-factor authentication keys, which are, you know, World of Warcraft, as a matter of fact, does that with an app. And I used to have an actual little dongle like you're describing that you would log in, it would say, give us your key code, and you would press a button on the separate little hardware dongle, and it would say 47293. And you would type that in, and it would be good for like 15 to 30 seconds based off of a time synchronization between the servers, your account, and that device when you registered it. And so based off of that, you have an algorithm, and they both sides can then predict that the number is 6, right? But one of the companies that's been around doing this for a very long time is Yubico. And the YubiKey, which we'll have a link to theirs in the show note, which is a very similar, you know, USB key factor that you plug into your device, and it basically is doing a similar time factor thing, but it's registered with the key itself. I think that might have been who Google used before they came up with the Titan security key, from stuff that I'm remembering, so I could be wrong. But there is that new standard that they've been talking about on FIDO for these keys. And so I think second factor key is important. I do it for some accounts, but not for others, because it's annoying as hell. Mm-hmm. Or there's not enough value in the account, and I keep my accounts all with separate passwords anyway. So the likelihood, if you broke into one of my I don't care about these accounts, it probably wouldn't have much impact on me. But I do think second factor is important. I do like what they're doing with this device, and trying to make one that they feel is, you know, pretty powerful, more available to consumers. I'm not sure pricing wise on some of the competitive ones like YubiKey, etc. But the more we can get people to understand that security is important, even for data that you don't care about.
Right.
That's important. I wonder, though, they do a Bluetooth key. That might be more interesting to me personally, because, you know, like you, my primary computing device now is a MacBook Pro with all USB-C, and most USB key devices are USB A or B.
Right.
So that wouldn't work. I haven't seen one of these in public yet, I guess is where I'm at. And I'd like to see it and play with it and then see what other companies support it. Now, there is a competing approach to security. That I really find interesting. And
is it subdermal?
It's called Squirrel.
Oh.
Which is by the Steve Gibson from Gibson Research Company and Security mm-hmm. Now mm-hmm. podcast. And what Squirrel does is, instead of having the magic keys and encryption and everything else kind of owned by the site or by the provider, it's a QR-based code security system where the user owns everything. And so you basically provide a token to the site to say, yep, it's me.
So it's a trust no one kind of structure, right?
Absolutely. So it kind of flips the whole thing. And when I look at companies like Google and Facebook and Twitter and Amazon and all those other ones that gain a lot of value out of having access to your data, second factor is absolutely important because we want to make sure that the security on that data is appropriately set up. But if they're holding the key, that gives them access to potentially more data than something like a squirrel approach to dealing with security. So I would really like to see when Squirrel rolls out, which is supposed to happen any day now, to have a third-party independent group kind of do a comparison between the two. Because I know Steve Gibson, who's the security researcher, he's a big fan of Second Factor and YubiKey and things like the Titan Key. But it'd be interesting to see a comparison of those two.
It certainly would. I mean, the price point of this one, it's at $50, it could easily be something to try, right?
Yeah.
Is the YubiKey in that general ballpark, or is it much more with Squirrel, or where Squirrel is free. Ooh, free is good.
Yeah, but it requires the websites to change. YubiKeys are $40,
mm-hmm.
so they're actually cheaper than the Titan Key by about $10. So that's again interesting. Not knowing the difference between the two's tech,
right.
Can't say, is that a good deal or a bad deal? But yeah, I mean, this whole space.
$10 is worth to you, I suppose.
Yeah. You can buy a tray, a YubiKey tray of 50 keys for only $1,920.
Oh, see, look at that.
One day. Yeah, yeah. No, this whole space I find fascinating. Because we know that people are willing to trade off security for convenience, right?
Sure.
And by doing something like this where you have that simple key, I mean, we use a key to unlock our doors at home. We use a key to drive our cars. We use a key, you know, to lock our file cabinets at the office, right? So people, for the most part, are used to using a key for certain things that they feel are important. So if you could simplify security to where login is based off of a key,
mm-hmm.
I think that's really important. The challenge that's important in reducing the trade-offs between security and convenience. If you're only using it as a second factor, then you really haven't gotten rid of the complex password aspect that you have to deal with.
Right.
And from my memory of what Squirrel will do is it solves that second half, right? In the sense that you log into your stuff yourself, and after that, the QR code authentication just validates for all the other sites. And so the convenience factor goes way up.
Right.
So
I'm just going through the YubiKey product finder, and it's got some interesting things around it. So you could get a USB-C type.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a USB-C type 4C, YubiKey 4C, and that would do that for you. Interestingly enough, it works with Dashlane and LastPass, although 1Password does not loom large here, so I wonder if that just hasn't happened as yet.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's interesting, too. They have an NFC-compatible key.
Ooh, cool. So that would, like, use your Apple Watch.
Maybe. We're back to the notion of a piece of hardware that why couldn't it work that way, too,
yeah.
Already? That you have something like an Apple Watch that is your key and you've authenticated to it.
Well, and that's what happens right now, right? When I go up to my Mac or my laptop, because I've logged in on my watch and I have at least logged in once on my laptop or my Mac, the pairing has occurred to where the next time I walk up to it, as long as it hasn't powered off and wiped the keys from memory, it mm-hmm. recognizes me and unlocks.
Right.
And if you were to take my watch off my arm, right. it wouldn't work because it loses the keys when you take it off the arm. So you'd have to chop my arm off, then walk up to my laptop. I'm not giving you any ideas, Michael.
No, I'm not taking any ideas. there's actually another version of this that is a little USB-C that you leave plugged into your machine. Leave it plugged into your port. No batteries, no moving parts.
Hmm.
Incidentally, that's a $60 thing versus one you put on your keychain, and that is a $50 thing. But then, you know, you're also taking these things out, and you got to plug them in, and you got to do this stuff, and it's like trade-off, again, like you said, convenience and security. I got to do a little more reading about this. I didn't realize that the two-factor authentication with SMS messaging had that had those kind of challenges.
Yeah, yeah. You really want to use a validating app instead of SMS.
Yeah.
So, as a matter of fact, I'll try to find. There was a deep discussion on it on Security Now a while back, and if I can find that, I will put a link in the show notes.
I like Squirrel too, by the way. The icon of that's pretty fun.
Isn't that cool? I really think. And there's a couple of competing things to Squirrel. I don't remember the names of them, but I've seen a couple other ones that are trying to do this same thing. So I like the approach of giving the security back to the user, and then requiring something on their end that they control. And the nice, I really like what they've done with Squirrel.
Well, and I like what they have here about just reading through the first page about not having to create accounts.
Yep.
Because you and I get prompted all the time hey, create a new account on this page, or even better, hey, create an account on this page by logging in with your Twitter or your Facebook IDs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as such, that does provide a high degree of convenience for sure, but I'm like, no, I don't want to log in with my Twitter authentication because now that site knows those things about me and potentially can start posting on my behalf or harvesting my friends or. So I don't do that. I always create an account, and it's a pain in the neck, and that's how my 1Password file has got hundreds of accounts. So
yeah,
this could be actually pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, have I said yeah?
Yeah, you have. You have, mm-hmm. and it seems a little bit like the way Apple's constructed Apple Pay too, right? So you have a single Squirrel ID, but it presents a different ID and password to every site that you're interacting with. So that's kind of cool.
As you know, one of my hobbies is security, and this stuff just fascinates me.
Yep.
So I grabbed a couple of different links from Security Now that are multiple times where they were talking about how two-factor SMS authentication has been breached and is not as secure as you think. And we'll have at least one of those links in the show notes.
Fantastic. I see them. Awesome.
Well, I know we're basically out of time. It's a holiday weekend, so hopefully you are holidaying.
I tell you, I won't be getting up at 5:30 this morning or 5 o'clock or tomorrow or whatever. I will not be doing that.
That sounds like a plan. Yeah. We hope everybody enjoys this this week's episode. You know, reach out to us on our various social media sites over at
Games. Set up an account with us.
Yeah, go to gamesatwork.biz and set up an account on our blog. all you need is to provide us with your name, your address, your Social Security number, the last four digits of your American Express
mother's
card.
Mother's maiden name.
Your mother's maiden name, and what Star Trek character you would be if you were in the Star Wars universe.
My head is exploding.
Have you had any time to play any new games this week, Michael?
Absolutely not at all. It's been a crushing focus, heads down sort of thing. So no, unfortunately. How about you? Have you?
Not a one.
Ah, well, that's the way it works sometimes. Maybe over this weekend we'll discover something new. And when we do, we'll share it with you right here on gamesatwork.biz.
Bye.
See ya.
You've been listening to gamesatwork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and we'd like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at gamesatwork_biz or at our website at gamesatwork.biz.